So Paul, why don't we just begin by reminding everyone that this is the 25th meeting of ICANN. It's a large meeting. I believe there have been that many. But we've been through a very, very busy week. And I think I'm going to let Paul walk through many of the issues that were covered. This is one of those very productive board meetings where we got a great many decisions made. We also listened pretty carefully to a lot of the input from the community. This community, as you perhaps have detected, is quite vocal in their views. And I think the atmosphere here in Wellington contributes to that. I didn't understand what it meant to be a Kiwi until I came here 3 years ago. And what I mistook for sort of blunt rudeness turned out to be just plain candor. And so there's certain value in all of that, as long as you understand that. And so we wound up with some pretty candid conversations during the course of the week. And I think you'll find as we talk about the rest of the way the week has gone, especially the board meeting, that the board has been listening to much of what we heard, and we have taken some steps to respond. So, Paul, perhaps you'd like to step through some of the things that we covered during the week, and then we'll chat perhaps a bit more and respond to questions.
Thanks, Ben. That's kind of given some detail. One of the big areas of ongoing discussion this week was coming out of the World Summit of Information Society. It's been the whole discussion of enhanced cooperation between public policy and the role of net organizations. And part of that is, a key part of that in ICANN is the reform of ICANN's Governmental Advisory Committee. So there's quite a lot of discussion by a working group chaired now by Ambassador Yanis Kartlands, the Latvian ambassador to Geneva, and also the past chair of the preparatory committee for WSAs. And Alejandro Pisani is the vice chair of the board of ICANN on specific issues for the gap reform inside ICANN, including things like transfer of the secretariat, where they have transferred the secretariat interimly to India. It will now be supported by the Indian government for this close interaction with ICANN and ICANN staff. Also talking about methods of working together. So there are some of those topics, and there's continuing work to be done on a lot of topics here on the ways in which the governments and ICANN interact.
If I could just clarify one point there, one of the things which is very difficult is the Governmental Advisory Committee tends to meet face to face with us and with the rest of the community 3 times a year at our meetings like this one. And what we are all sensing is a need to find a way to increase the pace of intersessional interactions among the government and between the board and the Governmental Advisory Committee. So we're looking for ways to get work done in between these face to face meetings. That's one of the discussion items that we'll be pursuing between now and the time when we meet again in Marrakesh and Morocco in June.
I think that's right. I think also the previous idea of the topics that I think come up to the conversation about priority areas of key engagement, they're going to be things, topics like WPA.com domains, internationalized domain names, IPv6 in the protocol allocation, resource allocation, the development and creation of policies on new GTLBs, and the topic of long discussion, issues around the who is databases. So there's some priorities that the GAC itself has identified as being areas that want to have a close working relationship with the ICANN policy process. I think one of the very interesting, one of the important parts of this meeting here in Wellington. Of course, the GAC delivered a formal statement of policy, public policy advice on one of the sponsored top-level domain applications in front of ICANN, that is the .XXX application. This is we coverage of various aspects this last 6 or 9 months, specifically focusing on individual governments with individual letters. The important part of this, I think a very important part of this, obviously this week, is the ability of the GAC to take input from various governments and to formulate that into a consensus position on public policy issues, which they've now passed on to their main contribution to the ICANN board. The ICANN board this morning discuss the receipt of that public policy advice and all the discussions that take place more broadly, and then direct the President and General Counsel to analyse all publicly received inputs to continue negotiations with the ICM registry, who are the applicants, and to return to the Board with any recommendations regarding amendments to the proposed STLD registry agreement. And I think importantly, reflecting where the GIC was coming from, particularly to ensure the TLB sponsor will have in place adequate mechanisms to address any potential registry violations of the sponsor's policies. This, of course, does not mean that the application has been approved, that money take place from the Board has all the facts in front of it, including this.
Any revision is going to meet some of these forward policy concerns,
but this is really an expression from the Board of taking into consideration the sort of input it's received on public policy issues from the GIC and telling the staff to negotiate, go back and talk to the applicants about how they intend to meet these sort of issues that have put forward. So I think that's actually a very good example of the sort of public-private partnership that ICANN is, and that of the sort of ability for the internet community working through ICANN to absorb in public policy advice from the governments. And I would particularly appreciate if the governments were able to come here. There's some nearly 100 governments in the GIC. I'm not certain how many were attending in face here. But their ability to work through together to come to some consensus amongst themselves what public policy positions were.
I know we don't want to spend all of our time on government relations, but I have to say that the job of ICANN is fairly broad in the sense that some of its job is very technical, making sure that we don't break the domain name system and we don't misallocate IP addresses. But selection of TLDs, for example, has a public policy component to it, and figuring out how to work with the Governmental Advisory Committee on a matter of public policy is, in fact, an important part of our learning experience as we try to fashion this multi-stakeholder organization in which the governmental group is part, but not all, and in which the interests of all the stakeholders have to be taken into account by the Board as policy is established. So this is actually as much publicity as we've gotten out of this particular top-level domain. It's been a very important learning experience to fashion a modus operandi between ourselves and that particular part of our multi-stakeholder group.
So thank you. That's a good point. Well, let me take you through a whole set of acronyms. Because I think one of the important things, and I think this is actually, I think these are actually big news items for the coming out of this meeting, were reports from our Security and Stability Advisory Committee, a group of eminent technical experts that we refer to as the SX, this acronym number one, who gave a report on the domain name system, known as DNS. Two reports. One was on distributed denial of service attacks on top level domains and renames and service and operators that took place, particularly commenting on a set of attacks that took place earlier this year.
If you're not going to be amplifying on that,
I was
guy wants to say, and this is very funny, right? The non-taking guy is introducing the taking report. This particular distributed denial of service attack uses normal natural elements of the domain name system to amplify a stream of requests going to those systems and then radiate them out to a target. So you take tens of thousands of domain name resolvers, servers that would normally just be answering the question, what does this domain name translate into as far as its internet address? And what it does is send a query using a false source address. And so the target is the one that looks like it asks the question. And the way the attack works is it looks like it asks this question to 10,000 different resolvers. So all the answers come back to it. So it's an amplification attack. And it goes against not only parts of the domain name system, but it could go against any particular target in the internet. So it's an extremely powerful kind of attack, and it's a very difficult one to defend against. So, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to do the very opposite and try my attempt at a very simple description of what we're talking about. Servers normally receive things like a wave on a beach. The dial of service attack would be presuming that there are those attacks. It might just be something like getting a tsunami on a fish.
That's fair.
This particular set of attacks was a tsunami 70 times larger than the previous.
And we have some indications that that represents a small portion of the total potential capability of the attackers to mount resources against the targets. So it's pretty scary.
Yeah, that's basically the bomb. And the important significance of this is that the committee released its report. It's called for its distribution both to governments but also to the technical community, with some specific technical recommendations for adoptions of certain technical responses. But I think you know, the great benefit that all the state can bring to this cause is actually getting that message out, because this is actually, although it sounds very techy, if you just take that analogy, this is actually a very serious change in the capacity of those people who are sort of doing attacks on the internet.
No, it's not. I wish it were. And this is more tech speak. But these devices are the ones that are used are open in the sense that they'll accept queries from anybody and then respond. And the reason that just shutting them down may not necessarily be absolutely the right answer is that they themselves form a kind of resilient fabric in the internet, so that no matter where you are on the internet, there will be some of these domain name servers that could be used, like if you're in a hotspot somewhere at Starbucks or what have you. So, although it's tempting to say, well, right away we should just shut those down, it might actually have some deleterious effect. The other thing we can do is to have the routers at the edges of the net actually check to see whether the source internet addresses, that is to say, the from address of these packets, are actually legitimate. If you're serving a certain population of service systems with a given collection of internet addresses, if one of them has been compromised and is asserting that it's an address that you know you don't serve, that packet should be discarded. The technical capability to do that exists, but is not implemented everywhere. I'm concerned about time. I'm concerned about getting questions from these folks. So maybe we should stop the rendition experiment that could happen and see if we have specific questions.
Well, perhaps we'll just finish very quickly by saying we had a long discussion about internationalized domain names and the process reduction of those into the top level domains, which is a big issue here in the Asia Pacific. The SAC, if you'll excuse the acronym, the Securities Health Advisory Committee, released a report also on the six stability and security aspects of alternative route operations. So that is an issue for some of the people on this call, at least, that have been following some of the discussion about alternative routes and how that might have affected. And the final thing, I suppose, just to say, we've board approved today the ICANN's strategic plan for 2006 to 2009, which is on our website, and which lays out, interestingly, not only the things that we need to do, but you might find it interesting to have a look at it, because it lays out what we think are 10 challenges facing the ICANN community in the next 3 years. For background work on this stuff, you might find those 10 challenges quite interesting. So, things to look at.
I'm sorry, now I'm prolonging everything, but the one other thing that happened is that the board made a commitment on behalf of itself and the staff to move ahead with GTLD processes, so that we would have a set of rules for creating new GTLDs or admitting new GTLDs, and our target is to try to have that set of procedures in place by the end of 2006. So that's a challenge in front of us. We don't know if we can absolutely guarantee to meet that, but it's our goal to be ready with a fully developed process for introducing new GTLDs.
We also have marvelous support here in New Zealand. And it was a very good conference. Everything worked very well. Very well coordinated. A particular thanks to ONZ for helping to bring that together and coordinate it for the committee. A thanks also to the Australian, New Zealand, and international sponsors. But it was fantastic. We had good bandwidth here. We were involved.
We did indeed. We also had very good support from David Thomas, the director of Ministry of Communications, who was extraordinarily enthusiastic. associate about having us here and to discussing various policy issues associated with the internet. So let's find out if you have some specific questions. Several different ways of actually implementing IDM TLDs. works satisfactorily in the root system. One thing I can tell you is that without getting terribly geeky, is that one of the two ways is fairly new. It's well defined, it's known, it's called dename, but it isn't widely implemented. So we haven't got a lot of experience with it other than the fact that it's a standard. So there's that testing to be done. There's also the question.
It's the dename, the other one is NS records.
NS records, yes, that's right, so that we don't wind up suggesting that we're only testing one thing, we're testing both. Thank you. The next thing that is an issue is once you imagine that someone wants to register in a new IDN top level domain, if you're the registrar, you might very well now have to adapt all of your own interfaces to make sure that you are able to deal with a TLD that's not written in ASCII. You may even have a customer service issue. Maybe your web pages for billing registrations have to be written in a new language. You might have to be prepared to answer the phone in a different language. So the WHOIS database itself, which contains information about the registrants, might also have to be able to cope with these new characters. So there are ancillary things in addition to the basic technology of domain name lookup and response, all of which have to be in place in order to make this work as well as the existing system does. So your question is, how long is all that going to take? And the answer is, I don't know. But our intent is to at least have rules for the creation of TLDs, including the IDN varieties, done by the end of the year, to have some testing done so that we know that technically the choices, all the choices that we know about work, and to, as much as we possibly can, stimulate the rest of the community that also has to make changes to try things out, at least think things through, and be prepared. But it will be, since this is a commercial activity in many places, it will be decisions made by the operators of the TLDs whether or not they wish to expend resources to prepare themselves for this.
Well, that's another question. Are there any?
So, clarify the records of announcements made. The meeting that there were three new senior vice president positions. There was a new president's committee on strategy, and I think there are new regional liaison officers. I just wanted to clarify, are they all measures that were announced at this meeting, or were they endorsed by the board at this meeting? What's the best of us is the correct way to describe those particular structures?
The top level of this is that the board is responsible for hiring and firing the CEO. Okay, so that's it. The organizational structure is his responsibility, and actually he was announced.
So that restructure was announced here.
The President's Strategy Committee was actually, well, that's true, was actually approved by the board in Vancouver, and his membership was announced here. And the regional liaisons were part of the budget was actually approved for 2005-2006, which we're implementing. And the senior vice president is referred to as part of the organizational restructuring that I was announcing.
That's the last one. And so just one question on the XXX application. When do you expect to make that? When do you expect to get back to the board with a response?
Will it be in Morocco?
Probably for the ASEAN.
Frankly, I would like them to come back sooner if possible.
It's a question of analyzing all the inputs that we now have from various sources relating to contract terms. And second, the staff will have to sit down with the ICM attorneys and work through any modifications to the contract agreement to address these various issues. My impression from the ICM side is that they're very prepared to sit down and work as quickly as they can to come to some language that they can agree with the staff. And so I expect that we will probably see this on the board's agenda before Morocco.
I wonder if there are questions on
Share common scripts for their languages.
I think one of the areas we're going to need to see similar cooperation is in the Indian Ocean, where we're going to, where some of the Arabic, Urdu, Farsi, other languages share the same sort of, probably not the same degree, but they do share some common characters. And so, one of the things we've been exhorting this week and talking to the Indian government representatives and others, to give, just give an example, is trying to see to the minds the need for regional liaison at the right level on those linguistic issues. Support. Yeah.
Any other questions on the line?
The next question comes from Angela Perez from Canterbury Today. Over to you.
Hi there. I have a pretty general question. I realise that you've done a 10 challenges with, but on a more basic level, what areas of expansion for the internet do you see as most vital and critical at the moment?
Are you asking about the general challenges for the internet?
Yes,
okay. Well,
maybe world issues have influenced.
Here are a few that you could jot down. First of all, it's scaling up. There are only 1 billion users right now. It's not enough. There are 5.5 billion more to go. Second, in many parts of the world, including New Zealand, there isn't enough broadband access for the residential users. And they, therefore, do not get convenient and useful access to some applications that require higher speed services. By the way, higher speed has two utilities. One of them, of course, is moving more data from one place to another. But the other is to reduce the line. The faster the speed of the line, so the less time it takes for anything to move across the net. And when you're dealing with very interactive applications, the load delay is more important sometimes than the amount of traffic that you can move. So that's a concern in many places, including right here in New Zealand, and in the United States, and in Europe, and elsewhere, where I've been traveling for the last several weeks. Another big issue on the horizon has to do with the introduction of new services on the network as a consequence of more devices becoming internet-enabled. So we're starting to see devices with global positioning satellite, or in Europe, Galileo positioning information. We're starting to see appliances of various kinds, entertainment appliances, office appliances, things in the car, things that you carry around with you, having internet capability. Many people with mobile phones or with personal digital assistants do have access to the internet, and they have access by way of radio links. So things like Wi-Fi and WiMAX and other radio-based services are increasingly popular. What that translates into, first, is a huge proliferation of things on the network, driving the need for more addresses. And this is why, although you might not remember, Paul mentioned that one of the issues of interest to the Governmental Advisory Committee is IP version 6, which has a vastly larger address space than the one you're currently using. You're using the 1977, well, to be absolutely precise, the February 1978 version of the Internet Protocol. So it's now 26 years old, and the IPv6 has 380 trillion addresses as opposed to V4, which only has 4.3 billion. So the larger address space should be enough to last until after I'm dead, and then it's somebody else's problem to worry about. So we're going to see more interest in mobility. We're going to see increasing interest in geolocation services. So if I have databases that contain information about what things are where, what services are where are my friends, all of that kind of location-oriented data will become increasingly valuable. So those are several of the things that I can foresee in the near term.
Thank you.
That's another thing. Yeah.
No, I just, this is the unfortunate advertisement that I have to put in, that I'm only on the line for 5 and 6 minutes.
So don't ask me any more questions.
It's actually going to be 15 minutes for the podcast.
Yes, that's fine. Great. So do we have more for Paul in particular?
At this time, sir, there are no questions in the queue.
Well, so they were working for So you shut down all the other areas in there without levels of interest.
So can you give some sort of general view on
how are you seeing the increased influence of governments affecting the way the internet is run, the way one of the local directs their people wrote to me just now? It used to be run solely from the point of view of stability, security, and supplying service. Now we've got all these ethical and moral things coming in.
So you should have answers, you have a short. If you have a short, forgive me, and if you want to be saying this, I used to be a government official in the previous life. I remember
I used to be a government
official. You do too. And I remember saying to somebody once, when we were at the beginning of the presenting afterwards, that there were a lot of the sort of early technical founders of the internet, at least in this part of the world, they were really proud of everybody was using their internet, and their biggest problem was everybody was using their internet. And I think the reality is it's gone from being an economic network to being a commercial network to being a fundamental economic and social underpinning. It's become, I suspect, the defining way in which humans will communicate in the 21st century. It's a basic infrastructure which will actually drive that. It's not that the internet's becoming more like other forms of communication. It's infrastructure, they're becoming more like the internet. And the consequence of which is that you're getting the same result that happened 5,000 years ago when, in Ur, they started to do writing. I mean, the issues of society and the issues of commerce, etc., are going to be involved in how that works. And we've had governments for at least 5,000 years as a way of trying to deal with coordinated society, so I don't think we should see government involvement. Government interest in the issues that emerge out of the internet as being anything but normal and a symbol of a positive outcome. Here's there's two things that come out of this. One is, first of all, a clear message that we think is very important from an ICANN perspective. The issues around the internet's addressing and routing system, which is one of the last parts of the stack of protocols, are very different from the issues that emerge about the content which that routing addressing system carries. And human societies have been discussing and debating what is acceptable content in their societies, again, for at least 5,000 years. You know, my own country probably for 60,000 years. And we should not expect it's going to stop now, and we shouldn't expect it's going to stop in the future. But it's very important as governments and public policies and big media companies and really struggles with that challenge, that we do not make the mistake of thinking that you can deal with those challenges by trying to rearrange the rules that apply to the addressing and routing system. The addressing and routing system is what gives you a single digital world, isn't it? And so that distinction, I think, is incredibly important. I think the second one, though, which you're seeing in the ICANN, is that we're also being seen at the moment, I think, at the beginning of the 21st century, very different from the beginning of the 20th century, where governments are now increasingly recognizing that this global infrastructure is truly global. It knows no boundaries. It's not designed with boundaries. But they actually have to engage with a global thing from their national jurisdictional perspective for the first time. And that means engaging in dialogue with parties who've been involved in building and creating, managing, populating that global technology. And I think this idea of multi-stakeholder organisation is going to be taken up further and further. I mean, for us, it's already big about 4, 5, 6 years ago. We talked about multi-stakeholder organisations, everybody, you know, we're a voice in the wind. We had 4 years of defending the model of the World Science Information Society, and now the model we think is really important, everybody else is espousing it's been very important, multi-stakeholderism. And I think we're going to see more and more that governments are recognising the limitations on their own capacities. And to achieve the sorts of objectives they think are important, they're going to have to engage and work with the people who actually make the network work or do these things. And I think that's why I think this decision of Triple H is so important here, because it's an illustration of a large group of governments working together to come to a common view about a public policy perspective and feeding that into a cooperative approach of how do we deal with a technical thing which has a global implication. In that sense, you know, when you write the history of the 21st century, you know, a few of these points are going to emerge. I think this is one of them, because it's actually, you know, in a broader context, it's quite a milestone to see, you've got a group serious place to get incorporated in. But they're doing it in the context about how to work with others who are influencing a global phenomenon. And they have these pictures.
I'd like to add to that.
In your own side of time, anyway. Typed up there. My first thought is that this isn't the first time that forces have been unleashed to change the direction of the internet. 1988, the internet is essentially operated as a research vehicle, and there's a military component to it. Various military elements of NATO were party to use of this system. The U.S. government, its military, and its primarily advanced research community is on board. No commercial use permitted. Backbones essentially paid for under government research contracts. 1989 comes along, and the rules get changed. The U.S. government says, well, maybe it's okay for commercial traffic to flow on this backbone. Let's change your mind about what was called acceptable use policy. Three commercial internet service providers arise in 1989. I was a big proponent of that because I didn't think that the net could grow, should be accessible to the business community and to the residential users unless it had an economic engine driving it. But I didn't think that any of the governments could possibly afford to pay for everyone's access to the internet, and I really wanted everyone to have access to it. Of course, my colleagues, some of them anyway, said, well, are you crazy? Let me wipe the line and run our elite network? So I still strongly supported this, and starting in 1989, you start to see other commercial forces now shaping the evolution of the network. You see commercial router equipment coming out, you see companies being invented to take advantage of this new kind of communication technology. And of course, Jim Berners-Lee, in 1989, comes up with his idea for the World Wide Web, and it kind of slowly leaks out until Mark Andreessen comes up with the Mosaic graphical interface to the World Wide Web around 1992, when he's in an academic setting somewhere. Excites the interest of Jim Clark, the founder of Silicon Graphics, and creates Netscape Communications with Mark Andreessen. Netscape takes off like a rocket in an IPO that blows everybody's eyeballs out. And the dot boom begins. Now we have Alan Greenspan's irrational exuberance. Money is pouring into venture capital, venture capital money is pouring into businesses. Anything that has anything to do with internet is suddenly exciting. And of course, this runs up like crazy. Optical fiber is being ordered everywhere. And then comes April of 2000, and we have the dot bust. Okay, so lots of people say, well, that's the end of the internet. It was a nice bubble. Except they aren't looking at the statistics. And the statistics are saying, you know, this thing is still doubling every year since 1988 in terms of numbers of users, numbers of computers, and traffic. And the actual growth rate now is probably not that dramatic or aggressive. It's probably more like 40% a year. Which, by the way, any sane businessman would kill to have that kind of growth rate. So, underlying all of the boom, bust, and everything else are commercial forces. But now, what's happened? The network is big enough. It touches so many places that there are public policy concerns about it or interests in it because it's affecting the economy, it's affecting the way people interact with each other, it's affecting culture. It is creating international interactions that might never have been possible before. In fact, the network was designed to be non-national in its character. The address space does not recognize national boundaries. The internet address space is completely ignorant of any boundaries at all. The domain name space, on the other hand, has some reflective elements of national boundaries. That's why we have country code TLDs as well as global or generic TLDs. The generic ones are completely non-national as well. So, of course, government gets interested in this because it has such a significance to every single government and it opens up new opportunities for commercial growth here in this country, especially. If you're going to have businesses in information technology,
I will say, I've said this many times this week, so I suppose I should say it again. You can't afford to build information technology businesses that do not service a global market. You have a domestic business here, you have a domestic market here, but it's a relatively small one. And if you want to really be serious about growing the economy, those products and services that are information technology based had better be configured so they can be delivered to and service people who are not in Israel. But you'll find some of your counterparts in other parts of the world, Ireland and India in particular, recognize that implicitly. They've learned how to export their talent without having the talent leave the country. And the side effect of that, of course, is that money comes in. You're reading the newspapers, and I know there's sensitivity to what's the state of the economy in New Zealand. And there's the people would like it to be more healthy. One way to make it more healthy is to grow new businesses. And one way to do that is to use the internet. So, that's sort of my little capsule view of what's happened over the last roughly 20 years. You got to go. All right. Well, I'm happy to keep going for a little while, and I have to be in a meeting too. I actually have about 10 minutes, so it's up to you. If you're done, you're done. Otherwise, I'll keep rattling on.
Finding as we work with our governmental advisory committee, we're finding new ways
to allow the public policy issues to become a part of the discussion and to affect the decision making. But it isn't necessarily the dominant element, it is one of the elements. Now, 10 years from now, it will be fun to look back and ask whether we are seeing a diminution of the nation state or not. Yes. Sure. There are several ways in which the denial of service attacks can be defended against. One of course is to just keep building more and more capacity to try to absorb the attacks. The attacks typically come as huge quantities of traffic flowing into the system against a particular target. That's a, in the end, that's probably a no-win mechanism, because after a while, you cannot outspend the with your own equipment the tens of millions or more of devices that are being harnessed by the opponent, because he doesn't have to pay for the equipment. All he has to do is invade it, essentially, and insert code. If it weren't for the fact that we have operating systems that have weaknesses in it that can be exploited, we wouldn't have as much of a problem as we have today with these denial of service attacks that are aided by what are sometimes called the zombie armies of computers that have been sort of the equivalent of a cuckoo's egg having been laid inside the computer producing a Trojan horse. How's that for a mixed metaphor? Just building more capacity will help point the effect, but it's not the long term. Some of the attacks are a side effect of being able to falsify the apparent origin of the traffic. And so this distributed reflective denial of service attack, which makes use of the domain name services, which are normally operating devices in the net, simply sends queries with a falsified source address. The answer goes to the target. And the only way to defend against that is to have the networks that are accepting the traffic to begin with check to see whether or not the source internet address is in fact valid. And if it's not a valid address for the community that you serve, so to speak, then you reject the traffic. A number of large-scale internet service providers are already doing what's called source internet address filtering. So that's helping to some extent. Another thing which can be done is to make the domain name servers that are now open, sometimes called recursive, to make them less open in the sense that they only service a set of users whose internet addresses are known to be legitimate for it to respond to. That may have the side effect of reducing the absolute number of domain name servers that any individual has access to, and that may reduce to some extent the resilience of the system to various failures, but it also reduces the potential for abuse in the form of distributed denial of service attacks. There are a number of other elements that we can apply here, including things like digital signatures in order to authenticate sources of traffic, the higher layers of protocol, just to make one example. So it's almost like a missile, anti-missile battle back and forth between people who want to abuse the resources. Some of them do this in order to, we think, I don't have anything other than anecdotal evidence here, but some of these people may simply be doing the distributed denial of service attacks to show they can do it, period. Some of them want to show they can do it, and they go to somebody and say, see what I did over there? I can do that to you unless you pay me for my protection service, which translates into, I won't do it to you if you pay me. Some people have various and sundry ways of describing that, anywhere from blackmail to greenmail. Some people may be using this technique in order to interfere with a competitor. Now, some of those kinds of activities are probably already illegal in other contexts. And so if you are able to find the party, you may actually have grounds to prosecute on the basis of already existing legislation.
some reason, such attacks are not subject to not subject to law enforcement because the legal framework isn't there. This may be something that could be dealt with both on a national level and maybe an international level. This gets to this whole question of what things should internet governance be about? And one of the things might be cooperative legal frameworks among countries to go after abusers of the internet system who are interfering with other people's ability to use it. So there's a lot of work to be done in the internet governance arena. And although much of the debate has focused on ICANN, which has a very limited mandate, this internet governmental forum, internet governance forum, is going to be meeting, I think, for the first time late in the year, October, if I remember right. And I hope that what will happen there is that a real discussion about the broad range of issues that need to be addressed will be tackled by that group, as opposed to focusing on the other functions that ICANN provides. I have to blast off.
Well, I have
time for one more. Maybe this is going to give me an open mic. Like one more last question. Okay, ICANN's specific responsibilities are to oversee the domain name system itself. And we don't operate any of it, really. We do operate a web server, but it's almost incidental. Our job is to set rules for what new top-level domains can be introduced into the system. We're responsible for dealing with redelegations of responsibility to operate TLDs, both in the country code case and in the generic TLDs. We have a responsibility for coordinating the allocation of internet address space. So at the very top level, our Internet Assigned Numbers Authority hands address space off to what are called regional internet registries. Those regional internet registries then hand off space to internet service providers who subsequently allocate IP addresses to users. So we are in an oversight and coordination role, but not necessarily in a law enforcement role. We're certainly not in a role providing content type services or anything else. We are concerned, however, about increasing robustness and resilience of the systems that we oversee. So we're very interested, for example, in being able to digitally sign the root of the domain name zone file so as to prevent others from providing false information that purports to be the contents of that root zone file. So we are working very hard on what's called DNSSEC, Domain Name System Security. And we work with the RIRs and others in the event that allocation policies for IPv6, for example, need to be adjusted to account for rate of consumption of the address space and so on. We would work in those areas. We support the Internet Engineering Task Force standards activity by taking instructions from them to put parameters into tables that can be easily found either by a human reader or in some cases by computer programs so that the protocols of the internet will be compatible wherever they're implemented. So if you want to make sure that his software and your software actually interwork, both appeal to the data tables and the specifications for standards, we don't generate the standards. We follow the instructions of the generators of the standards to maintain these tables. That's sort of an overview of what's going on. What's interesting about ICANN is that we are being asked to perform other roles that we had not originally anticipated or planned for, which cost more money. Many countries that are still learning about internet and how to manage, for example, the domain name service, are asking ICANN for assistance in just organizing things. We don't do the organization, but we might advise. And so we're finding ourselves doing more of this kind of outreach activity than we did before. Okay, that's all the time we've got, I guess. So thank you very much for taking time to sit in this cold room. If you go outside, it's probably more comfortable.